Okay, if you would, take out your Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis 49. When you get there, somebody tell me what's happening here in Genesis 49, towards the end of the book. Blessing on whom or of what?
Okay. Things that would happen in the future. It's called a blessing. Sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Mm-hmm.
Statements can be made by one. Very important statements about you.
Okay. And so in Genesis 49, Jacob is blessing his sons. Jacob is nearing the end of his life, and Jacob is blessing his sons. And so, as Dempsey just mentioned, one of the sons primarily that is blessed there with a positive thing is Judah. So look in verse 8, Genesis chapter 49 and verse 8. Judah, your brothers will praise you, and your hand will be on the necks of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. Judah is a young lion. My son, you return from the kill. He crouches, he lies down like a lion and like a lioness. Who wants to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah or the staff from between his feet until he whose right it is comes and the obedience of the peoples belongs to him. And we'll stop there for just one second. I want you to see one thing here is that the blessing continues after that, but this is the part of the blessing that we are most familiar with. Why are we most familiar with this part? What does it say about Judah? Okay, so if we're just reading this at face value, Judah is going to have, or Judah's family or house is going to have some level of prominence over the others, right? So, and in particular, this is royalty language. The scepter will not depart from Judah, the staff from between his feet until he whose right it is comes. And so in your Bibles, that he whose right it is, that's the capital H-E. And so as Eddie said, we're looking forward to some individual of prominence. And it says the obedience of the peoples belongs to him. So this ruler is going to come from Judah's house. Let's continue this blessing, though. Let's look at what else is said about Judah and his house. Verse 11, he ties his donkey to a vine and the colt of his donkey to the choice vine. He washes his clothes in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth are whiter than milk. Now, what does that mean? What is all of that about? We got the royalty part, and usually we just kind of move on from that. But what does verse 11 mean? He ties his donkey to a vine, the colt of a donkey to a choice vine. He washes his clothes in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. I had to kind of look this up. And so really the image here is one of abundance. The house of Judah is going to be so abundant and so blessed that wine will flow as if it were a flood. It will be so common in Israel or in Judah's house that they could wash their clothes in it. It would be as common as water. And so there's this kind of image of abundance and riches and blessings that are flowing. Okay. Keep that wine image in your head. Now, turn to Isaiah chapter 25. Isaiah chapter 25. So we already know that we're talking about a prominent individual, an individual of royalty to whom the nations are going to be obedient and through whom a great blessing is going to come. Isaiah chapter 25. Let's pick up in verses 6-9. The Lord of hosts will prepare a feast for all the peoples on this mountain. So there's that abundant language again. A feast of aged wine, choice meat, finely aged wine. On this mountain, he will destroy the burial shroud, the shroud over all the peoples, the sheet covering all the nations. He will destroy death forever. The Lord God will wipe away the tears from every face and remove his people's disgrace from the whole earth, for the Lord has spoken. On that day, it will be said, look, this is our God. We have waited for him, and he has saved us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. So, through Judah's house comes this individual. Who is Isaiah 25, or what is Isaiah 25 talking about? What is it foretelling? It's foretelling Jesus. It's foretelling the one who was to come from Judah's line and would make wine as abundant as water, so common that it would, you could just use it for common everyday purposes. And you could tie your donkey to a grapevine where those choicest of grapes would come from. And now it says about this individual, he will destroy the burial shroud. He will destroy death. And we will look at him and say, look, this is our God. We have waited for him and he has saved us. And so when we see this feast of the Lord, the feast of aged wine, choice meat, finely aged wine. So this imagery of wine, this fine wine, something that's provided in abundance, something that's provided that is better than anything that came before it, is what they're looking forward to. So let's fast forward now to the time of Jesus. What are they looking forward to? Or what have they been looking forward to? They've been looking forward to the king, right? And we'll talk a little bit more about why they might have thought it was that particular time even in just a few minutes, okay? So now let's go back to John then, John chapter 2. We started talking last week about the feast at Cana, the wedding feast at Cana. And this is the first of seven major signs that John presents to us as proof that Jesus is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God that was to come and take away the sin of the world. And so that first sign, as John will say, is turning the water to wine at Cana. So let's go over there. Let's read that account and then let's get some meaning from it. And what I want us to kind of keep in our mind as we're reading through this, you know, you may have asked the question, why is this the first sign? Because John, as you can see, he leads up. These signs kind of ramp up in intensity over the course of the book. Why didn't Jesus start with the raising of Lazarus? I mean, you know, as the master of the feast will say, everybody gives the best wine first. Why not start with the best first? Okay, so let's read through this account and just kind of keep those things that we just read in mind as we're going through this. John chapter 2 and verse 1. I'll tell you what, let me have somebody else read it. Can somebody read John 1 through 12? Chapter 2 verses 1 through 12. I do all the reading, so go ahead.
The third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was also invited to the wedding with his disciples. The wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Now there were six stone water jars there for Jewish rites of purification, which was only 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jar with water. They filled it up to the brim. He said to them, now, draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. They took it. The master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine. Did not know where it came from, but the servants had drawn the water. The master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, people that are freely in the poor, you have kept a good wine until then. This, first of the signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, manifested his glory. His disciples believed. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days.
Okay. So we began talking about this story last week. We kind of had to rush through it there at the very end. Thank you, Joe, for reading that. Again, Cana is about 5 miles away from Nazareth and probably between 10 to 15 miles away from the Sea of Galilee, where Capernaum is. And so it's possible that Jesus' family had some sort of connection to this family. And that's why Mary would have been heavily involved in the wedding preparations and those types of things. So when we see Mary speaking to Jesus and asking, you know, telling him the wine has run out and expecting him to do something. Well, first of all, Mary doesn't have a Joseph anymore, presumably. So Jesus, as the eldest son, is there. And so who else is she going to turn to but one who might have some, you know, connection or ability to do this. And we talked about the importance of a Jewish wedding feast, that if the wine ran out, it would be a very embarrassing thing for the family and for the bride and the groom in particular. So what we have here is a wedding feast. I don't know at what point in the feast we are. Jewish wedding feasts could go on for anywhere between a week to 10 days. And I don't know at what point in the feast we are, but it's a bad thing that the wine has run out at this point. And they apparently don't have any sort of easy solution to get more for the guests, or at least to get more so that the guests don't know that this has happened. So what we've got here is a problem that needs a solution. And the problem about the problem is it's a seemingly insurmountable problem. There's something going on here. And so Mary turns to Jesus. She tells him that the wine has run out. And he gives these kind of two cryptic statements. First of all, woman, what does that have to do with me? Or what is that between me and thee? Is really how that verse is plays out. And I don't think he's being disrespectful of Mary here. Again, the term woman is not like a woman. It's a term of respect. Madam is kind of what we would use today. But Jesus almost seems to be saying, like, you know, why are you bringing this to me? why is this our issue? And he says, my hour has not yet come. Now, we can only speculate about what he means by my hour has not yet come at this point. But as I mentioned last week, this phrase will be repeated 6 times. Throughout the book of John. And it always refers to Jesus indicating that he's not ready for his plan to progress to the next level yet, or at least not to get to the end of that plan yet. And so that tells me Jesus is in control of this plan. We see things happen to Jesus, but he knows what's coming. He always knows what's coming. And he knows the perfect thing to do next. And so he says, my hour has not yet come. Does he mean the hour of his revelation to the public? Because as yet, again, this is John saying this is the first sign. We don't know what that is. But however Mary takes it, however Jesus means it, she turns to the servants and she gives this very important statement. Whatever he says to you, whatever he says to you, do it. Because Jesus' intervention is the only solution to this seemingly insurmountable problem, and Mary is confident of the results, whatever they may be. So, yes.
This is something I've pondered for many years. It strikes me that Jesus is almost asking a rhetorical question to Mary. Why do you think that it's time for this to occur?
Right.
I don't think it's criticism of her. Mm-hmm. It may be more like when God told Abraham to offer his son Isaac. Mm-hmm. It may be just a question of Jesus, do you realize what you're asking me to do, or do
right.
you realize that what you're asking me to reveal?
Yes.
And it seems like her response in turning to the servants is essentially saying, yes, I understand what you have come to do. Now, obviously not everything about it, but it's almost a statement of faith on her part.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his statement to her was really a question. Do you have the faith?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she does. And she does. Okay, so let's look at the solution then. Okay, how does this solution play out? Well, verse 6. 6 stone water jars. What are these water jars for? For cleansing or rites of purification. Okay, what is that? What does that mean? What are these for? When they're getting ready to pray, I would go even simpler than that. For washing hands and feet, right? This is the kitchen sink. Okay? This is the sink. Now, maybe they're dipping water out and pouring it on hands and feet. I don't know. But either way, are you going to get drink for a wedding feast out of the same jars that you use to clean hands and feet? Don't miss that. Okay? So John gives us these little details. Read into the details in these accounts. All right? So here's something that's used for a base purpose. And what do we read about the quantity and quality of these jars? Okay? So there's 6 stone water jars, each set there for Jewish purification. So the wedding guests can wash their hands. And I mean, you said to come, Mary, you said to come to prayer, but it does have to do with purity, right? They don't want, if there's anything unclean that may be on their hands, they want to be sure they're not ingesting that. And so they're cleaning their hands. So this is less about sanitation and more about ritual purification. They're washing off uncleanness. Okay. Keep that in mind in terms of Jesus, right? All these little details have some nuances to them. Now, it says about these that each jar, and there are 6 of them, contain 20 or 30 gallons. Mine goes ahead and translates it to modern equivalents. 20 or 30 gallons. So if we are extrapolating that, we've got jars anywhere between 120 and 180 gallons of water. That Jesus says, fill these up with water. Okay. Imagine that much Milo's tea at a potluck. Right. Okay. So Jesus then tells them, fill the jars with water. How much? How full? All the way to the brim. Okay, fill the jars with water. And so they filled them to the brim. And then he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the chief servant. So this individual is kind of the master of ceremonies for the wedding feast. Okay, he's the one that's making sure that everything goes smoothly. He's the one that makes sure that the preparations are in order. And so this would be embarrassing for him too, for the wine to run out, by the way. Right? I would say 120 to 180 gallons, probably overkill in terms of what's needed for the guests. Maybe there's that many people. Maybe they're double dipping a lot. But the need is met above and beyond what is requested. Now, this is going to be a theme in John, this abundance theme. Remember, so this goes back to what we were talking about in Genesis and Isaiah. This abundance theme, providing more than was expected or what is needed. And God is pouring out blessing. Okay, so we think, for instance, we're going to get to John chapter 4 eventually. Eventually. We're going to get to John chapter 4, and he's talking to the Samaritan woman. And he tells her, if you had known what kind of water I could give you, you would have asked for it, because I will give it abundantly. You will never thirst again. Okay. And then a little bit later, we're going to get to the feeding of the 5,000. Well, did the 5,000 each get their own portion? And then that was all? They got a little loaf of bread, one little fish, and that was it? No. Everyone ate until what? They were full. And then there were baskets and baskets left over. So this theme of abundance is important to John, and that's what he seems to be getting at. Okay? So not only is it abundant, but they dip some out, they take it to the master of the feast, and the master of the feast has no idea where this wine has come from, but he drinks it, and he says, what? Okay, all right. Well, the best for first in this case. Yep, the best for first. Yep. You save the worst for last. Yeah. So verse 10, everybody sets out the fine wine first, the inferior, but you have kept the fine wine until now. Does anybody have any other translation there besides fine wine? Good wine? Okay. Anybody else have the best? Does it say the best? Okay. That's neither here nor there. I think the good wine is really the best. So this is the best kind of translation, because think about this. The master looks at the wine or experiences the wine, and he says, it is very good. Does that kind of ring any bells for another event where somebody looked at something that was perfect and said, it is very good? God himself, when he creates the stages of creation, he looks at creation, he says, it is very good. Okay, so these little callbacks are just always there. You have saved the good wine. You have saved the very best until now. Okay, so let's kind of get the big picture of this, and then we'll move on from this particular story, and I'll ask for any commentary if you have any. So we said this is water that's for purification. This is sink water. Okay? Something mundane has become something desirable. Something that has no honor except to be used and thrown out now has become the very best that this master of the feast has ever tasted, presumably. Okay? So what we're suggesting then is the superiority of Jesus over some previous provision or revelation, which was at that time believed to be the best. And is that not one of the main ideas of the Hebrew letter? Okay. Here was something that was given, something that you have placed your faith in, something that you have lived your life by and tried to do so to perfection. And yet, something better has come. You were given the tabernacle. A better tabernacle has come. You were given sacrifices. A better sacrifice has come. You were looking towards a land. You should be looking towards a better land, because that's what your ancestors were doing. And so this idea of something better, something abundantly better, seems to be the idea that John is trying to get across with this first sign of the water to wine. So on the face, you know, we might look at this miracle and we might say, this is just, it's just really odd. First of all, that this is the first sign. And secondly, why is this the sign? Of all the miracles Jesus did, why this one? And so Jesus seems to be setting the stage, and John by giving us this. Any thoughts or comments on that, Eddie?
I really appreciate your inclusion in Isaiah 25, mm-hmm. because there's two themes in that chapter, in that prophecy. Mm-hmm. One is the wine, the other is life. Mm-hmm. It talks about wiping away every tear, overcoming death. That's Revelation 21 and 22 language.
Yes, it is.
And when you put that in with this miracle and look at the other six miracles, the signs that you get up there, every single one of them has as its root life. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's what John said was the purpose of his gospel.
Yes.
That believing you would have life in his name. So every one of these signs, in one way or another, is pointing to the idea that Jesus came to give abundant life.
Yes. Give life and give it abundantly. Yes. Yes. Very good. David. Best. Okay.
Master of the feast here, the same good that the master
Mm-hmm. It's possible. So David asking, is the master of the feast seems to be a bit player. First of all, he could be kind of a metaphorical, right? I mean, I think he is a real person, but in the sense of the story, the master is the one that's providing. The master is the one, and yet someone even greater than the master, than this master of the feast, the one that has the prominence in terms of the feast. Jesus is just a spectator, you know, at this wedding up until this point. And yet he comes in and the wedding is saved because of him. The master couldn't overcome the problem. Jesus could. So that's entirely possible. I mean, I'm open to anyone else's thoughts on that. What role the master plays.
In your study, have you seen the rumor in the past of who the figure in the community or who the figure in the family, whoever it was, that was the value of the master?
I don't know. I mean, it could even be a hired individual, like someone that this is their profession. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, we, you know, somebody in your family could be a wedding organizer, or somebody, you could hire somebody to kind of be the, I honestly don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
They already believe them. Mm-hmm. It shows that faith can and will grow when we get partnered with the mass.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Bible story.
Mm-hmm.
John 20, 30, 20. Written that you may believe.
Yes.
The more you read, the more you experience and practice, your faith continues to grow.
And there's one other detail in verse 11 that we need to underline. That we might skip over in this. So it says, Jesus performed this first sign in Cana of Galilee. He displayed his glory. And so, you know, we might look at this feast and we might say, well, this is for the benefit of the people that are there. They're getting the fine wine. They're also getting the lesson from the wine, hopefully. The glory is going back to Jesus. It's his glory. He displayed his glory. And if you go back to chapter 1, remember, chapter 1 and verse 14, the word become flesh, took up residence among us, and we observed his glory, the glory as the one and only Son from the Father. And so John is telling us then that the purpose of this sign is so that Jesus can be glorified, that he displays his glory, and the disciples then believe based on that glory. Right? So glorification of the Son is also a major theme throughout the book. So anytime you see that word glory, glorified, glorification, circle that in John. You may want to make printed off copies of John so that you can mark them up, because there's all kinds of stuff in this book that's like that. Okay, very good. Very good. Thank you for the comments on that. Let's move ahead then to the next story. I want to be sure I keep on my time schedule here. All right. Chapter 2, will somebody read verses 13 through the end of the chapter real quickly?
At the Passover of the Jews, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and money changers seated. He made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. He poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who were selling the doves, he said, "Take these things away. Stop making my father's house a house of merchandise." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for thy house will consume me." The Jews therefore answered and said to him, "What sign do you show us, seeing that you do these things?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews therefore said, "It took 46 years to build this temple. Will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, And they believed the scripture, the word which Jesus had spoken. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, during the feast, many believed in his name, beholding his signs, the signs he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, was not entrusted himself with them, for he knew only. And because he did not need anyone to bear witness concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man.
Okay, thank you. Right. Do the other gospel accounts have a similar version of this story? Is this story somewhere else? Jesus casting out, overturning the tables of the money changers? Yes, they do. Okay, so I've got them up there on the screen, actually. Matthew 21, Mark 11, and Luke 19. What juncture of Jesus' ministry does that event take place? And I would say those are all three an account of the same event. What juncture of Jesus' ministry does that take place in? What's the timing of the Matthew, Mark, and Luke events?
Near the very end.
Near the very end. Okay, so Jesus is in his last week, right? He's come to Jerusalem, and presumably he will not leave there until after his crucifixion. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke place this event towards the end. Where does John have it? Well, we just talked about the first sign, right? And then it says Jesus went down to Jerusalem, and then this event happened. So there's really two theories on this. First of all, the first theory is this is a singular event, and John has placed it out of order on purpose because he's more concerned with thematic storytelling than in linear storytelling or chronological storytelling. He put this here for a reason. Or the other theory is that there are two temple cleansings where Jesus has a similar reaction. And so if that's the case, we kind of have to wonder at this. We have to wonder maybe why there are two instances where Jesus did this. And what would the significance of something like that be? Keep your thumb here in John 2 and turn with me to Leviticus chapter 14. Leviticus chapter 14. This is a tangent. I'm going to throw that out there right now. And quite honestly, I only saw this theory in one place, and I'm always wary about one person having a theory that nobody else seems to have. But I want us to see something here in Leviticus 14, and even if it's not a direct call to a direct link to what's happening in Leviticus 14, maybe the concept applies. Okay? Leviticus 14. I know how much you all love Leviticus. You're all there on what's happened in all the chapters of Leviticus. Maybe you remember our study of Leviticus a couple of years ago. Leviticus chapter 14 is one of those fun chapters. It's about skin diseases and about mold that can get into a house. Contamination. And let's just use that phrase, contamination. Okay? So in Leviticus 14, look in verses 33 through 53, so the latter half of the chapter. We're not going to read this whole thing, but just a brief rundown of what's supposed to happen. So if someone discovers that there is some form of contamination in their house, they are to go to the priest and tell them, and the priest is supposed to come and inspect that house. If the priest determines that this contamination is something other than just a smudge on the wall, then they are to tell that person to start taking everything out of the house, clear the house, and then they will come back after an appointed time, in this case, 7 days, and they will look at the house again. And if the contamination has spread or is still present, then the house has to be taken apart stone by stone until ultimately there is no house, because you can't have this kind of contamination in the midst of the camp. Okay. Now let's start to kind of put some threads together here then. If these are two events, one happening at the beginning of Jesus' ministry and one happening at the end. Okay, Jesus, let's kind of put all this in the metaphorical sense. Jesus goes into the house. What's the house in this case? It's the temple. That's right. Jesus goes into his house, his Father's house, and he determines that there is a contamination in the house. What's the contamination in this case? It's sin in the form of greed and avarice and taking advantage of the poor, presumably, because, I mean, there's money changers here. They're charging. This has become a place of business. It's a selfish place of business. So there's a contamination in this house. Well, what does Jesus do when he discovers the contamination? He runs them out and does what? He turns the tables. He gets rid of what's in the house, just like Leviticus chapter 14. Okay? Now, it's not 7 days. I mean, if this is the beginning of Jesus' ministry and the second one is at the end, it's more like 2.5 to 3 years. But Jesus comes back towards the end of his ministry, and what does he do? He discovers that the contamination is still there, and he cleanses it again. And he says, if you don't make a change, this house, he's speaking to his disciples in Matthew 24 and other places. He says, there will not be a stone left in this house that will be left on top of another. The house is being dismantled stone by stone. So again, this is a theory. We could take it literally. We could take it as, you know, an image for one that's being put onto another, or we can just at least use the concept. You know, we always refer to this event as Jesus cleansing the temple, yet that word is never used in either of those texts, is it? It doesn't say he cleansed the temple. It just says he overturned the money changers' tables and all of those things. So why would we make that leap? And you know, that's just the Bible editors putting those titles in there. But the concept is the same. Jesus is getting rid of the corruption. And if that corruption doesn't leave, if that corruption is not taken care of, the house is going to have to be torn down. Does that temple get torn down? Stone by stone? Oh, yes. Yes, it does. And I mean, and that'll be talked about later on in the New Testament as well. So just again, these kind of levels of meaning as you're going through these stories and maybe thinking about why they're there and what they're intended to do. Now, the one mark against that theory for me, if I'm just being fair, is John does not give us the second time. When Jesus comes back into Jerusalem, John never talks about a second time that this happens. Likewise, Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't give us a first time that this happens. So again, it's a theory, but tangent over, bringing us back to the story now. Okay. So Jesus is in Jerusalem for the Passover. Ted.
I always thought the miracle of this account was that Jesus cleansed the temple.
They didn't do anything to
him. Everything that it was this, the presence of a hog. But if you start taking money from thieves,
mm-hmm.
or people like that, I mean, they would have beat him, they would have thrown him in jail. Like,
oh, yeah.
This kind of hog.
Yep.
But just what an amazing miracle of protection.
Yep.
That God ought to have him to do that at that time.
And to me, that goes back to the phrase of my hour has not yet come, right? Because Jesus is in control. He knows. And if you go through the Gospels, tangent statement again, if you go through the Gospels, is Jesus ever touched by a malevolent force until he wants to be? Think about how many times it says Jesus passed through the midst of the crowd, or they saw him no more and they weren't able to do anything. It was not until Jesus said, this is the way it's got to happen in the garden, until he's actually taken.
It's interesting you brought that up. But Ted brought that up. It made me think of when John's account of him coming to arrest him in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that Jesus said to them, John tells us, they all fell down.
Yes. Yep.
And it wasn't until he literally gave himself to them that they took it in.
Right.
And so this account is pretty good. We see here at the beginning where they don't lay a hand on him. And even at the end, they don't lay a hand on him until he gives himself to them.
I mean, he'll tell Pilate, right? You would have no power over me unless it had been given to you from the Father above. Okay, so Jesus is in control. Jesus is always in control. Okay, let's finish this story real fast. I want to get through chapter 2 today. So Jewish law permits the selling of animals, right? So you can have poor people that just don't have the flocks and things that are required to give the sacrifices. And so the Old Testament, the Old Law actually makes provisions for this. The problem is that they're selling these things, and I would assume at a premium, in the midst of the temple. This isn't a marketplace outside. They're in the temple courtyard. And so they've turned the temple into this place of business, not a place of worship. So Jesus enters the temple then, and he has an emotional reaction to what he sees there. We don't have to turn there, but consider Malachi's words about the Lord coming into his temple. Remember, Malachi is prophesying, he's the last of the prophets. And what he says about this individual is, the Lord you seek will suddenly come into his temple. Skip down, he will be like a refiner and a purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver. Skip down again. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to the Lord as in the days of old, as in former years. Then I will draw near to you for judgment. I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, adulterers, those who swear falsely, those who oppress the widow and the fatherless, and against those who thrust aside the sojourner and who do not fear me. I will be a witness. So one of the major themes of John, if we're talking about all those major themes, is people are witnessing Jesus. Another kind of flip side of that, though, is that Jesus is witnessing people as well. Jesus is seeing what the reaction to him is. So Jesus is acting as a swift witness. How dare you turn my Father's house into a place of business? Now, we often use this passage as just a justification for anger. You know, Christians to say, can Christians get angry? Is it okay for Christians to be angry? Well, yeah, Jesus got angry. Oh, yeah, he did. If we only use this passage for that purpose, we have completely missed the purpose of the passage. And I know Jesus makes a whip, and presumably I look at the whip as just kind of an ancillary detail. Like, you got to have some way to get the cattle out of the thing. So he's not whipping people. He's whipping the beast to get them out.
I remember years ago, Brian Crawley was teaching a class on this. Mm-hmm. And he asked us, show me in this passage where it says that Jesus got angry. And we're all thinking, well,
that's true.
That's what we're doing, is we're putting ourselves
on
Jesus.
Yep.
It does not say that he was angry with you.
Right.
Now, there is a passage in Mark that says Jesus was angry.
He was angry.
But it doesn't say here. In Isaiah 42, there's a prophecy of the Messiah. And one of the things it says is, he will not cry out and raise his voice. He will not make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break. The dimly burning victory will not extinguish.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same Jesus that's here.
Yes, it is.
So whatever we think Jesus is feeling or doing here has to fit in harmony
with
what we read there about the Messiah.
Yes, yes. Because we've got to look at that and determine what's our example going to be as well. How is our zeal going to play out? Very good. So, lest we think, though, that Jesus was completely stoic or serene. I think we always think of Jesus as the stoic Jesus, right? That just kind of walks around and sees things and says things. Lest we think that Jesus was completely stoic or serene at all times. His actions here do reveal some form of passion. And so then it says that the disciples remembered that it is written, verse 17, zeal for your house will consume me. This comes from Psalm chapter 69. I was going to have you turn over there and read this, but we'll just hit the high points of it. And I want us to see something about this. Okay, Psalm 69 is a Davidic psalm. Psalm 69, putting it in context, says, verse 6 of Psalm 69, do not let those who put your hope, who put their hope in you be disgraced because of me, Lord God of hosts. Do not let those who seek you be humiliated because of me, God of Israel. For I have endured insults because of you, and shame has covered my face. I have become a stranger to my brothers and a foreigner to my mother's sons because zeal for your house has consumed me, and the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me. Okay, so when Jesus does this, who is he acting against? Is he acting against Rome? Who is he acting against? He's acting against his brothers, his national brothers, right? The Jews. Okay. Now, continue the thought there, though, in Psalm 69. I mourned and fasted. It brought me insults. I wore sackcloth as my clothing, and I was a joke to them. Those who sit at the city gate talk about me, and drunkards make up songs about me. So those who sit at the city gate would be the elders of the city. They're the highest ranking officials. Drunkards would be the lowest officials. And he says, everybody from top to bottom insults me. Why are they insulting him? For what reason? What does he say? Because I mourned and fasted. Because I wore sackcloth as clothing. That's why. Because I was penitent. Because I had zeal for the Lord. That's why I was persecuted. And so he'll go on later in that same chapter to say, you know the insults I endure, my shame and my disgrace. You are aware of all my adversaries. Insults have broken my heart, and I'm in despair. I waited for sympathy, but there was none, for comforters, but found no one. Instead, they gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. We can pull that forward and see where this is going to lead, right? But the question we have to ask, though, the thing we need to see is, when David wrote this psalm, we know that David conquered many peoples. He conquered Philistines. He conquered all kinds of nations. Who were David's worst enemies? When David was in the lowest points of his life, who were his enemies? Was it foreign nations? Nope. It was his own people. Because zeal for your house has consumed me. So John is foreshadowing here. Okay. He's setting the stage for what's coming. Okay, so they come to him, they say, what sign are you giving? Was that the second bell? Oh, it was. Almost. Okay, we'll finish this up next week and then we'll get into Nicodemus. Thanks a lot. I know.